This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A drug that was hoped to prevent cardiac arrest actually ended up causing it in many heart patients, possibly as many as tens of thousands. My guest, Thomas J. Moore, has written a new book about the story, which he describes as America's worst drug disaster. His book, Deadly Medicine, raises larger questions about how we test, approve, and market prescription drugs. The drug Moore writes about was developed to treat irregular heartbeats, a condition known as arrhythmia. The chemical name of the drug is flecainide acetate. Moore follows how the 3M company developed and marketed it under the brand name Tambacor. The drug is still prescribed for people with life-threatening arrhythmias, but for several years, the drug was more widely prescribed. Moore says this was in spite of evidence showing how dangerous the drug could be. In the second half of our show, we'll speak with Dr. Robert Temple, the FDA's Director of Drug Evaluation. Thomas J. Moore is a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Health Policy Research. I asked him what the antiarrhythmic drug was designed to do.
This was a family of drugs whose principal use was to suppress very mild premature heartbeats, often so mild that only a cardiologist could spot them on an EKG. The patient didn't even know them. They had a theory. The theory was if you suppress these mild premature beats, it might prevent very lethal electrical breakdown of the heart that kills people. Unfortunately, the theory was wrong.
What was wrong?
When, after hundreds of thousands of patients were taking these drugs, they were finally tested to see if they had health benefits for the patients, it was discovered this whole family of drugs did not prevent death. It caused cardiac arrest in about 6% of the heart patients who took the drugs, a truly shocking death toll.
What are the names of the drugs that fall in this family?
The names of the drugs include Tambacor, Rivmal, Tonocard, procainamide, Mixitil, and a variety of drugs with the generic name quinidine, and they have names like Quinolan, Quinaglute, Cardioquin, and Quinidex.
What should patients who take these drugs do? Are doctors still recommending that patients keep taking them?
There's an important warning for everyone who takes heart medication. It is dangerous often to stop any form of heart medication, including the drugs I've been talking about, without consulting your physician. This is not a do-it-yourself project. However, if you are taking an antiarrhythmic drug for a condition that's not life-threatening, and we now know that there are thousands and thousands of people doing this, you might well want to get a second opinion from a cardiologist.
Does the FDA recommend the use of this drug only for people with life-threatening conditions?
The FDA says that these should not be used for non-life-threatening disturbances. There are slight differences in the label for each drug, but that's the thrust of this. This drug is today approved for only heart rhythm disturbances that are so severe and persistent that the patient's life is actually endangered.
Now, your study of these heart drugs lead to larger issues within the pharmaceutical industry and the medical testing area. So I'd like to get to some of those larger issues. Why don't we start with testing? How were these antiarrhythmic drugs originally tested?
Interestingly, they were tested at some length. The feature drug in the book called Tambacor was tested for 12 years. But there was a large gap in the testing, large enough to drive a truck through. The 3M company was not required to prove, believe it or not, that the drug benefited patients. They were only required to prove that it changed their electrocardiograms. So as a consequence, we didn't have the key piece of information. So often it's not how much or how long, it's asking the right question. And almost always the right question is, do drugs benefit the patient directly, and are we sure of it?
Well, how did such an important test end up not asking the question, does it help the patient?
Truthfully, it was too expensive to answer that question, and the government didn't make them do it. You can prove that you can change an electrocardiogram with a relative handful of patients observed perhaps only a few weeks or a few months' time. If you want to prove that a group of patients has a lower risk of death, that sudden death will be prevented, you would literally have to study many hundreds of patients over many years' time. And the drug companies didn't want to pay that money if they could sell these drugs without that testing.
Now, did that original set of tests show any dangerous side effects?
One of the most important things I thought went wrong as I researched these drugs was that even in early testing, people tended to drop dead with an unusual form of cardiac arrest soon after starting therapy with these drugs. And one of the most puzzling threads of this drama in deadly medicine is, why did the experts in the field who often saw these cardiac arrests with their own eyes disregard this evidence and let the drugs be prescribed for thousands and thousands of patients?
What do you think?
I believe they were too close to the drug industry. They were too wedded to a theory that it was beneficial. They disregarded study after study that failed to prove the benefits, but they were very close to the drug companies. Their career depended on drug promotion and drug development, and they literally failed to see what was right in front of their eyes.
There was a more recent test of arrhythmic drugs done in 1989, sponsored, I believe, by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute.
Yes, and this is what you might call drug testing after the fact. After almost 1 million people took drugs for irregular heartbeats, the National Institutes of Health sponsored a very expensive $40 million randomized clinical trial to find out whether they had benefits for patients. After only about 1 year of testing, they came up with a shocking answer. Not only were there no benefits, patients were dying in shockingly large numbers.
And I believe the test was discontinued when they realized how many people were dying.
So many patients died that they had to halt the test to protect the patients in the trial. Practically all the cardiac arrests that they were recording in the patient population occurred among those patients who were taking the active drug, not the patients who were taking a harmless placebo.
Now, the first studies that were done on these heart drugs, they were organized by the drug companies?
Clinical studies are organized, conducted, and paid for by the pharmaceutical companies, typically, in order to obtain the approval of the FDA. But they're actually conducted, usually, in medical school research centers.
You said that these drugs were not proven to prevent cardiac arrest?
Yes.
Yet the drugs are still being prescribed for people who have life-threatening irregular heartbeats.
Well, this is true, but at least among those with a life-threatening irregular heartbeat, the drug has a demonstrable effect. That is to say, a person has a heart who has a kind of electrical short circuit, and it's beating so rapidly that their health and life is compromised. Sometimes these drugs can stop that life-threatening irregular heartbeat. Now, these drugs may also have great risk of killing the patients, and I wish we were more confident and had better data to make sure that the benefits of these drugs outweighed the risks. But at least in this group of patients, we have real benefits that a physician can see. In the other patients, they had mild irregular heartbeats and that the patients couldn't even detect it. They were taking a drug that was all risk of dying, no benefit.
Thomas J. Moore is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Deadly Medicine. He's a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Health Policy Research. Let's bring the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, into the picture. The first of these drugs for treating irregular heartbeats was approved by the FDA in 1985. The FDA saw the results, obviously, of the initial round of tests. What was behind the FDA's decision to approve the drug?
This was one of the most dramatic moments in the book. The senior physicians at the FDA sensed the dangers of Tambacor and drugs like it. They had observed that there were these mysterious cardiac arrests, and they proposed to restrict the whole family of drugs, including drugs already on the market. But in really one of the most pivotal points in this book, they get talked out of it under pressure from the pharmaceutical industry, because the money was to be made from treating mild irregular heartbeats. That's where about 7/10 of all the patients were. And the drug companies wanted the money, and so they pressed and persuaded the FDA to relent, and as a consequence, the drugs were approved without the severe restrictions that might have saved thousands of lives if they had stuck to their guns.
What was the restriction the FDA first considered putting on the drug?
they proposed that it be limited only to life-threatening ventricular arrhythmias, which is the limitation on it today, and additionally, that the drug be started during hospitalization, which would have made it very difficult and very expensive to begin this drug, and only a select group of patients with truly life-threatening conditions would have ever taken the drug, instead of millions of people with irregular heartbeats so mild that they couldn't even tell they had them.
The FDA saw that the drug was killing some of the people taking it in the studies. Why did the FDA approve it?
That is one of the most moving chapters in the book, because the senior doctor who had the final say literally lists the deaths on a piece of paper one by one. There was someone who had dropped dead while gambling, another person who had died at a picnic, another person who had suddenly dropped dead playing tennis. He could not be sure in which case the drug was responsible or the patient's heart condition, but he was worried about the evidence. Nevertheless, he was persuaded there were patients with very serious rhythm disturbances who would be helped, and so he moved forward to approve the drug, but with severe restrictions.
But then those severe restrictions were eased up.
And he got talked out of it by the pharmaceutical industry, by the expert consultants to the FDA who also worked for the drug companies. They said, no, this drug isn't as dangerous as you think. And of course, when a drug is not properly tested, you can't quite tell just how dangerous it is.
I think you imply that medical experts who worked on FDA panels were compromised by their relationships with drug companies.
I go much more than imply it. I state and document that the several senior experts upon whom the FDA relied for advice about the safety of these drugs were allowed to perform this function at the same time they were receiving many thousands of dollars from the drug industry to test these drugs, to promote them, to do other sorts of work on them and write about them, usually favorably in medical journals. I believe that the lethal properties of these drugs would have been spotted much sooner and understood much more quickly if the FDA had not relied on medical experts with very close ties to the drug industry, with open admitted conflicts of interest we would not tolerate in any other type of governmental activity.
The FDA put tighter restrictions on the use of these drugs after the 1989 National Institutes of Health study was released, the study that showed the dangers of the drug.
Yes, but the response of the physician community, Terry, has been terribly disappointing. Just last week at the American College of Cardiology, a new paper showed that one-third of physicians continued to prescribe this family of drugs for patients with mild irregular heartbeats, the exact group that the FDA now warns against. There was another survey that showed 81% of the cardiologists surveyed were not taking their patients off these drugs if they had earlier prescribed them. And so widespread inappropriate use of these drugs continues. But if you go to the FDA and ask them, why aren't you doing something about this, they shrug their shoulders and say, we can't tell doctors how to practice medicine.
Why do you think there remains inappropriate use, inappropriate prescriptions of these drugs?
I believe that physicians either don't want to call their patients in and admit they made a terrible mistake and prescribed their patient a drug that had no benefit and might have helped kill them. And I believe that's a very hard thing for physicians to face honestly with their own conscience, and an even harder thing for them to admit to their patients. And so an awful lot of physicians just hesitated to take their patients off the drugs. Second thing, obviously some physicians didn't get the word, because not every drug was covered in this NIH trial. They just decided to assume, well, maybe the other drug, because it was not implicated, directly included in the trial, maybe the other drug was safe. But we have no evidence that drug was safe. The FDA says it's prudent to assume every drug in this family contains similar risks.
There's a movement now to deregulate the FDA. Newt Gingrich called David Kessler, the head of the FDA, a thug and a bully. Gingrich called the FDA the country's number one killer and criticized it for discouraging innovation and not approving drugs quickly enough. And he would like to design a replacement for the FDA. You're a critic of how the FDA handled these drugs to treat irregular heart rhythms. Would you like to see the FDA dismantled?
I would go completely in the opposite direction and believe that the evidence is that the FDA is not strong or independent enough to ensure that our drugs are adequately tested today. The Republican proposed changes would simply loose more untested drugs that might kill thousands of more people onto the market and would be a disastrous mistake.
You say you don't think the FDA is independent enough. What are the forces that you think are acting on the FDA that might compromise it?
The AIDS community, pharmaceutical companies, patient groups put incessant pressure on the FDA to let them have drugs that are not very well tested. There's almost nobody out there. I can't tell you how lonely it feels to be one of the very few voices out there saying, we need safe drugs so they don't kill people. There are just a few people like me. There is a vast army, often supported with huge amounts of money from the pharmaceutical industry, pressing for lower standards and less testing. Sometimes people are just medical optimists and they would rather have hope than evidence of benefit. Sometimes it's drug companies that know they can make more money on drugs that don't have to undergo so much expensive testing.
My guest is Thomas J. Moore, author of the new book Deadly Medicine, a study of the testing, approval, and marketing of a controversial heart drug. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thomas Moore is my guest, and he's the author of the new book Deadly Medicine, and he's also a senior fellow at George Washington University Center for Health Policy Research. Another issue I want to look at that relates to the study that you did in your book, and this has to do with pharmaceutical company profits and marketing. Now, you say in your book that the amount of money spent on drug research in the pharmaceutical industry is smaller than the amount of money the drug company spent on actually marketing the drugs to doctors, advertising the drugs to doctors.
To me, the largest scandal that I came across, if you will, is all we hear that drug companies need to be twice as profitable as other companies because of their expensive research and development. I learned that one quarter of the prescription dollar goes for high-pressure marketing, for gimmicks and trinkets for doctors, for 10 billion free samples a year, for symposiums at luxury resorts where you can adjourn from a little one-sided presentation to go skiing if you're a doctor. The patient does not see the suffocating embrace that the pharmaceutical industry holds the medical profession.
You mentioned free samples within there. I've surely gotten my share of free samples from doctors over the years, and it saved me money.
I believe that this is one of the tools that the drug industry uses to manipulate doctors to get them to try new drugs. I believe that the doctor should be relying on well-fashioned clinical trial information, not a trinket or a sample to decide what's best for the patient. They would not give away so many drugs if they knew it didn't influence doctors, and they are not using facts, they're using gimmicks and gifts. And maybe you like not to pay for one set of drugs, but wouldn't you rather pay a little for a drug that you knew worked?
But I assume when a doctor gives me a free sample that the doctor has some faith in the sample that he's giving me.
I assume that too, but that's how they sort of hook doctors on particular drugs. That's how drugs that are not very thoroughly tested often replace drugs that are better tested through free samples and patients like them. Maybe they have a few less side effects, but they are not proven to have the results. And when this system goes wrong, the results are disastrous, with literally thousands of people dying.
Are there other reforms within the medical profession or the pharmaceutical industry or within the FDA that you recommend after having done the research for your book, Deadly Medicine?
There are three really important things we need to do. We have to cut out the conflicts of interest. The same doctors who work for the drug companies and promote drugs should not be allowed to help the FDA judge their safety. That, to me, is an intolerable conflict of interest. Secondly, we need to sever this cozy relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the nation's doctors. It's time to put trinkets and gifts and luxury resort symposia behind us and start evaluating and prescribing drugs based on the hardcore testing results. Thirdly, we have to test our drugs better. Every drug, we need to know that it benefits patients, not that it makes some little change in the electrocardiogram or blood pressure goes up or down or some laboratory measurement changes. We need to know that the patient gets better, feels better, or lives longer. Those are the hard bedrock standards by which you decide a drug is safe and effective. And every time we get away from it, we may pay a terrible price.
What kind of research do you do before taking a drug that you're prescribed?
I don't happen to be taking any prescription drugs right now, but I recommend that everyone should read that what's called the package insert or label, which your pharmacist will give you. You may have to puzzle through it, or get one of the volumes in the library that describes the medical uses and the side effects of drugs. It's very important, especially for any long-term drug that you take over a long term, to know what its properties and side effects are. If you have any questions, or maybe also ask your doctor specifically, what are the risks of these drugs? What benefits can I expect? What are the most likely side effects I should look for? These are the kinds of questions you need to ask about every drug you take.
I want to get back to the FDA. Given that we're in the middle of a move to deregulate the FDA or do away with it, how would you like to redesign the FDA if you had a chance to do that?
The FDA needs a little more of everything. It needs more money. It needs more staff. It needs not the worst world's worst working quarters in the world. It also needs the ability to either order, pay for, or conduct drug studies that the drug companies can't or won't do. Part of the reason that needed studies are done is the drug companies think they're too expensive, and there's no money to pay for the studies. Also, the FDA needs to do a better job monitoring the adverse reactions of drugs. We have a hit-or-miss system that depends on a doctor who just thinks he might have seen an adverse reaction. We need to systematically study the adverse reactions of new drugs after they're introduced. These are the most important changes.
Well, who should pay for expensive drug studies?
The answer I have is the consumer pays in the end, no matter who conducts it. We could do it either through regulation, through acquiring more studies, which would raise the price of drugs. We could do it through establishing an institute like the National Institutes of Health that was capable of doing drug studies that perhaps the companies couldn't reasonably be required to do it. We could do it by subsidizing the drug companies for certain kinds of... There are a lot of tools to get the studies done. I don't think that's as important as realizing that we aren't doing the right studies now to be sure that the drugs we have are directly benefiting patients, not affecting some laboratory measurement.
Thomas J. Moore is the author of the new book, Deadly Medicine. He's a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Health Policy Research. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.